All right. Well, so are we going to have our big serious conversation episode?
Well, which one? Did you also wanted to do something on the 50th?
Well, I thought we'd do that later. And we could do that anytime.
Okay.
But, so we've been doing this podcast. This will be the 21st podcast.
Yeah,
21. And, you know, when we set out to do this, we talked about how we never wanted to really delve into politics or anything too overly not political or religious or things like that. But with what's going on in the country and in the world, we've been talking about how we felt like we needed to have at least somewhat of a serious conversation on what's happening around the country. Mm-hmm. And I think what we decided to focus on, and I guess it could stay non-political, I don't know, is to talk about how the country seems to be sort of splitting apart. You know, you're getting, well, just like you were talking about, you get these groups who you've got one side here and one side here, and there seems to be no in the middle. You know, there's just this non-lack of coming together at all.
Yeah.
So we were going to talk about that, and I was thinking about this. I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm sure you do too.
Sure.
Is why is this happening? And I'm curious to get your thoughts. I mean, my initial thought is always that, well, it's rural versus urban.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of where that's where it seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get your thoughts. What are you thinking when you see this kind of split happening in the country? I mean, is this new? Is this old? I mean, what's your take on this?
So yesterday, and you commented on it on the you know, there was that old Kentucky Post that had a link to a Courier Journal, the Urban League president, and or two of the Urban League executives from Louisville wrote this opinion piece about the op-ed about the monuments, the Confederate monuments, and that's kind of what they wrote about, is that they're like, in context of that issue, they were making a point that there are only two sides, that you've got to go, you know, you've got to go one way or the other on this. Either you think they're wrong, and I think this would be true, that they need to come down. I think they were even going so far as that. It's not, you can't just say, you know, that you don't get to take these, that they're wrong, but that's okay, we're going to leave them up. I think
I don't know if they were going so far as to say I think what they were trying to say was, we want to remember the past. That's important.
Right.
But we need to do it in the proper context. Like putting a Confederate soldier in the center of town square is not the same as saying this Confederate soldier was a traitor to his country. That's kind of the point they were trying to make, I think.
Yes. And so they were sweeping. I feel like that they were sweeping the people that would say, sort of, I wish this monument had never been put up. What kind of, is there another solution here type thing? Anyway, they were sweeping those with, look, you can't. I think they're kind of sweeping those with the people that would say, no, we got to keep them up because it's history and that sort of thing.
No, I agree.
And there's the people that say, no, we've got to make an actual physical change now. And so anyway, all that is to say that, there does seem to be more, like, whatever you're talking about, there's more and more pressure to sort of, like, line, which side are you on? You know, line up, commit. You know, sign up for one side of whatever issue you're talking about. So that's, you know, I mean, today, you know, we've got this with, this is in the news today about that President Trump is getting, clobbered about, you know, supposedly make, you know, there's some kind of question about whether or not even a deal was made, but about the
Dreamers.
The Dreamers. Right, exactly. You know, that it's not, you've got to be kind of like totally either one way or the other on that question, you know. anyway, there's people that want to do that. So I would just, I guess, you know, my grand thought about your point is that, yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, it seems like, and I tend to be a person who's kind of mealy-mouthed in the middle about a lot of stuff. All right. And actually, I shouldn't even say that. I don't think it's mealy-mouthed. A lot of people on the edges of things would say it's mealy-mouth. I don't. I mean, to me, it seems like kind of a faithful position.
Right.
Peacemaking position. But I don't know.
The Dreamers thing is actually a very interesting one because I think, you know, Margaret and I talked about this the other day. There's a push to make the whole Dreamers thing a moral thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, well, you're morally wrong if you're opposed to allowing these people to stay in the country.
Sure.
And on the other side, it's no, you're morally wrong because you're allowing criminals to get away with being criminals in our country. And that's morally wrong. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, they're both saying, well, I've got the truth on my side.
Yes.
And I hate to say it, but, you know, that sort of to me points to the fact that, well, maybe we need to find a place in the middle to meet.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, I don't know. I mean, I don't know where you come down on the whole Dreamers thing, but I think what it makes me think about is the fact that why can't we have an actual discussion about what's the real issue here? You know, the fact that did these people get into the country illegally? Yes. Is that against the law? Yes. Should we allow people to just openly flaunt and break the law? No, obviously we shouldn't.
Right.
But in cases, these were like 3-4-year-old kids, and this is their whole existence. They don't know any other life outside of here.
Right.
What is our moral obligation as a country? What do we owe them anything? Do we want them to be our chosen immigrants? You know, like, do we want to embrace them? I mean, I think that's the conversation we're missing, right? It's like we're too busy yelling at each other to actually – nobody's actually listening to the other side. I think that's the part I don't understand to me that I just don't get. You know, when I talk to my dad, who's very much a big – immigration guy, like he really wants them to be better about enforcing the immigration rules and things like that.
Right.
He has no interest in kicking these kids out. You know, he understands that this wasn't their issue, that there's a way to make this work that could work for everybody and not be such a negative thing.
Yeah.
I keep thinking that if you have one-on-one conversations with people, you can find that sort of common ground, middle ground where we can all come together. But I don't know why it's reached this point where it seems like you can never have that conversation.
Yeah. You know? Well, everybody, you know, the edges on both sides and the ones like the NRA crowd constantly gets – like from my side of the aisle, we're constantly criticizing them for their slippery slope. You know, that any sort of like gun regulation, that's a slippery slope. So we're just going to oppose it all.
Right.
And from my side of the aisle, we just think that that's like, you know, wrong. And like we criticize, you know, totally sort of like criticize them for that thinking. Although I would say that same sort of principle of like being fearful of the slippery slope, you know,
that's what's playing out now with the Dreamers.
It's totally on the other side too. I mean, it's, you know, the left, we do that with all sorts of things too. Okay. So now taking it to, I mean, this is a weird, like, we're not really talking about any of these issues and maybe, you know, whatever, we're just kind of talking about the state of play, but the Colin Kaepernick, for example, that's where like take him. To me, he is like sort of representing this middle ground position, you know, like that you can. OK, he has found like by doing his anthem protests in the football games, that is a peaceful, you know, is a peaceful way to use the power that whatever power, you know, he got into the public sphere or whatever. The way that he got in, here's something that he has a way to sort of like make an impression known, but do it in a way that I think is peaceful, totally peaceful. I mean, literally, he's kneeling, you know, it's a passive position, you know, he's kneeling actually, or, you know, now guys are starting to raise a fist, but in any event, whatever you call it, that is not, you know, that is not tearing down a monument in Durham, right?
Right.
It's not the same. It's not the equivalent. You know, it's a peaceful protest. And he is also saying, you know, I still want a job from this organization. You know, I still want to be employed.
Right.
You know, he's still trying to get, you know, the reports are that he's working out and that sort of thing. He still wants to be employed by an employer that's choosing to play the national anthem, you know, and those sorts of things. And so to me, he is sort of that. He's representing this, like, sort of like, you know, a reform, more of a middle ground, middle approach, reformer type position that it seems to be less and less highly regarded all the time, no matter what particular issue you're talking about. You know, instead, what you get is both sides, you know, from both sides, screaming that the other side is morally
well, and that's, I mean, in essence, that's kind of what happened to him, right? He did the initial thing, mm-hmm. and then both sides jumped down his throat. Mm-hmm. You know, one side was saying, well, why would you do that? That's disrespectful to the flag. That's disrespectful to everybody mm-hmm. who's ever served in the military. That's horrible. And the other side was yelling and screaming, well, you're privileged. Do you think you have, mm-hmm. you know, what are you really standing for? You need to come out and, like, say it. You should be doing more than just kneeling, taking a knee. I mean, I mm-hmm. kind of feel sorry for him because I think he was legitimately trying to be, you know, like you said, just make a public statement without saying anything. Just make a public show and say, mm-hmm. you know, I think there's a problem here. And, you know, I mean, it's – they've talked about this on PTI so much, you know, the Kaepernick thing. Mm-hmm. And Kornheiser started saying, I don't know, six months ago now that – the problem with the Kaepernick conversation is there is no middle ground anymore.
Right.
Like, you're not allowed to have a middle ground attitude. You're either on this side or that side. There's no in between.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of with you. It's like, well, actually, I think there kind of is a middle ground there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's – you know, I think it's funny, too, because I've never understood – why, and this is something I don't quite get at all, but I've never understood why the NFL didn't just have the same response the NBA did,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, the NBA immediately came out and said, it's the rule you have to stand for the anthem,
mm-hmm.
period. Like, that's mm-hmm. our rule for our players.
Mm-hmm.
If the NFL had done the same thing, this would have all been forgotten, it seems to me. I mean, it's funny, nobody called the NBA on it. Everybody said, well, they're a business. They can do that if they want to. They're trying to avoid controversy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just, the whole thing's just weird to me. And yet here's this guy who doesn't have a job. And I think most people agree it's because of what he did. You know, it's not because of his play. He wasn't that bad. My gosh, have you know.
Yeah.
The NFL's full of horrible quarterbacks. Like the Colts couldn't use him?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, now that it sure seems like that sort of like it's football reasons. That's shakier ground all the time.
I think what he threw. I know he wasn't that great the last couple of years, but last year didn't he throw something like 13 TDs to 3 interceptions or something like that? Like,
oh yeah,
how bad can you be? You know, that's I don't know. Anyhow, yeah. But
no, I totally agree. I mean, I think that. You know, now I was not convinced initially that it had to do with.
Yeah, I wasn't either.
Because it seemed like.
Well, people have been souring on him as a football player for
some years.
For some years, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. But, now, you know, regardless, we're still talking about a relatively young player.
Yeah.
And you know, now it starts to. I'll tell you what, if it is football issues. Then, to me, it actually, if we really are talking about a football problem, then it really is more of a I mean, I haven't even seen this voice, but I start to think then if it's football, then we really are talking about some race problems still, because we really don't. We have this huge organization that still does not have a space kind of like for African-American mediocrity, right?
Sure.
You know, we're willing to celebrate African-American exceptionalism, but if it comes down to mediocrity, you know, by and large, we're just going to employ the white guys.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah. To me, don't be, you know, unless you're willing to own that and make that explanation, don't be talking to me about football issues, because if you want to go down that path, what you've convinced me of is that we're really not that far away from, you know, making Tony Dungy become a defensive back in 1975 or whatever year that was, you know, not Doug Williams not having a job through a lot of the 80s,
right.
You know, stuff like that, which is just was total jive. And it felt like, oh, we have kind of crossed that chasm now where you can have, you know, where it was one thing to have like
that's black a good star. Point, Eric. How many backup African-American right. quarterbacks are there?
And we kind of had that, right? You did start to see that come to play. I mean, Byron Leftwich, for example, African-American guy, and he stuck around in Pittsburgh for a backup for some years. Charlie Batch, you know, some types of stuff like that. And so it seemed like we had crossed that point where, okay, not only could you have like sort of the outstanding African-American athlete make it, even that didn't exist in the as a quarterback. Even that didn't exist in the 60s and most of the 70s. And then we got to the point where, okay, you could have the exceptional. And then we've even gotten so far as kind of the mediocre. And now if you're telling me that Colin Kaepernick can't have a job because of football issues, I'm starting to question whether, oh, did we move back on that sort of mediocrity?
That's
because
I
promise you, Colin Kaepernick is at least as mediocre as Jay Cutler.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. Cutler. I mean, Joe Flacco. I mean, I'm sorry. Has Joe Flacco done anything since he led the Ravens to the Super Bowl? Yeah, that's on Kaepernick, right? As well, he hasn't done anything since he led the 49ers to the Super Bowl. Well, neither is Flacco, but he's still getting paid $30 million a year.
Yeah, the guy who started the game for the Jets this week, McNown.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, there's a number of places where you have to say, how could you possibly argue for this guy, Kaepernick, just on football issues? So there's that sort of thing. I don't know.
I think what, you know, to me, sometimes I wonder. So there's two things I look at. One is, of course, rural versus urban.
That
there does seem to be a huge split there. You know, if you look at the blue, who voted for Hillary and who voted for Trump, it's pretty much right down that line.
Yes.
If you look at education, right, that's another one, right? The more educated versus the less educated. And it's funny because if you go back in time, like if you go back into the 60s, you could probably make the exact same arguments about what was going on then, the Vietnam protest and the attitudes toward Vietnam and the attitudes toward drugs and the attitudes toward all that stuff. I mean, in some ways, it's like we've never really gotten over that.
Yeah.
You know? And I do wonder if that's – sometimes I do wonder if that's the case. Like that – you know, we had these years in the middle where you get Reagan to come in and Reagan embraces things like money and wealth and power. And he also embraces, you know, hardworking America. And so you get this – both sides love him, right? Because they love him in the cities because he's bringing all this money into the cities. You know, their economies start to boom and they're making tons of cash and he's taking all the restrictions off of them. And then they love him in rural America because he's praising them and talking about how great they are all the time. And you know, and Clinton's kind of the same, you know, in a lot of ways. But I don't know. At some point, all that started to sort of roll back to the old way of looking at things. You know, well, I don't know. I think what worries me is I don't see anybody bridging that gap. Like, I don't see there being somebody coming up in politics or certainly the internet. Helping to, you know, bring those two sides closer together. If anything, it just seems like it's wedging further and further apart.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, politically for sure. I mean, you know, things are really, some interesting things, you know, that are going on. I mean, I think that it turns out that sort of like Bernie Sanders is sort of playing is starting to play like this Nelson Rockefeller role in, not Nelson Rockefeller, Barry Goldwater role in the, for the Democrats who lost, and that, you know, like his single payer, you know, he kind of like has proposed a single payer thing and tried to, you know, that was more about, it seems like politically anyway, it seems more about like sort of resetting the stakes for the Democratic Party and, in trying to get all the Democratic senators to sign on for support of single payer. Well, that's the sort of, it's sort of what, Goldwater did when he lost in 1964 so badly, and it, you know, kind of reset the borders of what the Republican Party was going to be, and then you had Reagan sort of become the giant champion of the Goldwater GOP, and that seems to be sort of what Sanders has staked out for himself, where he's trying to move the Democrats definitively left now, and making everyone kind of get, and you know, for me, I mean, that is my politics, and so I'm happy. I mean, it, you know, I like that, but to this point kind of like how to get along in the world, I don't know. It's just challenging. I mean, it really is. It's hard to get.
But the problem is, Eric, I think what really concerns me is we're reaching the point where we can't make a decision about anything.
Yes.
You know, right. it's like
governorable.
I mean, we all agree that there's a huge infrastructure problem in the country.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think everybody on both sides agrees with that.
Yeah.
And yet, of course, now when Obama, he wanted to do a big infrastructure bill when he first got elected. And the Republicans essentially said, never going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to block it. No matter what you do, we're going to block it. And part of that was just them being obstinate, I guess. And part of that, too, I think, was Obama being a poor enough politician to not know how to put the screws on them, to put them into a position where they had to do something.
Yeah.
And so it just died away. And you know, you see the same thing playing out with Trump. I mean, Trump ran on this notion that we're going to do this huge infrastructure overhaul. And, you know, it's like the Times had a big story about that recently. And the thing they were saying was, you know, it's going down the same path they went with Obama, essentially, that, you know, there's too much wrap up on other things. People are ignoring it. It's kind of getting pushed to the back end as we focus on all this more bipartisan stuff. And
yeah.
So it's funny, you know, you got this one thing that we could all agree on, but we're too busy arguing about everything else to do anything.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's the part that really concerns me. It's like, well, we've reached the point where we can't pass a budget. Yeah. You know, we can't do anything.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I have to say I'm intrigued by what's happened this week or the last couple weeks now with Trump turning toward the Democrats, because what he's obviously able to do with that is put a lot of pressure on his own party.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's just kind of interesting. You know? I mean, it's funny. I mean, Obama tried that with the Republicans, but of course they just weren't willing to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
They refused to
to
do anything. Period. Yeah, you know, they were going to go against him no matter what he did. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, because your boy, you know, your boy's famous comments about that. So.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. I don't know. It's really. You know, it's kind of Congress. Nothing can get through Congress. And so then you get these sort of you know, in broad strokes, what it feels like as someone who's not, you know, any more informed than reading headlines, you know, as they pop up all day long, and then spending, you know, 30 minutes consuming the news as best
right.
I can.
No, same here. Yeah, I know what you mean.
That's all you can do as a working person, right? You know, you can't be engaged enough beyond that to know more. But as far as that, what it looks like in broad strokes is the congressional the legislative can't do anything. That is just total gridlock. And it's, you know, the minorities can just throw, you know, the minority party is what I'm talking about. The minority right. party can just throw a wrench in the works and just stop it, altogether. And, whoever that is. And then, you know, the presidential branch, so it resorts to sort of like more and more executive order type stuff that then just, you know, can totally be reversed.
Well, DACA is a great example of that. I mean, DACA, if anybody had ever taken the time to challenge it, it probably would have lost in the courts. But because everybody sort of wanted a program like that, mm-hmm. or thought a program like that was okay,
yeah.
everybody just sort of let it go, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know, it's weird. That's a weird one, like how that's all played out too. But I think I'm sorry, go on.
Well, and I was just going to say, and then the judicial branch, now it's becoming this thing of like, in which court do you appeal?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Thing. We don't, now we're working off, we're moving toward, I don't think that it's like, maybe it is dramatic, I don't know, but it doesn't seem so totally dramatic yet, but now, you know, where we were, the judicial is supposed to be set up as like, we're all working off the same book, and, right. you know, it's going to make me sound like a strict constitutionalist, but we're also, the judicial is supposed to be like this sort of like singular thing, but now, like, depending on which court, you know, you strategically pick which court you're going to appeal something because they interpret so completely differently.
Right.
And so, man, that is a, I don't know enough about history to know whether or not those three branches are, you know, maybe they've always worked this way. Maybe it's always been this way and we just didn't have as much coverage or whatever, but it feels distinctly different than what I understood from civics class, you know, in high school.
And, well, I think people have commented on the fact that, you know, if you go back to the 80s, for instance, yeah, they would argue on the floor, but then senators would go off and have dinner together from both sides of the aisle.
Kind of that
And so they knew each other. They were friends outside of competitors.
Right.
And, you know, from everything you read today, I mean, that's just, it doesn't exist anymore. You know, they don't like each other, period. So it's, you know, that does change things. I mean, if you see the other person on the other side as not just your competitor, but as sure. the enemy, it does completely change how you think about making laws with them or doing deals with them or anything. Because you're always afraid they're going to try to get something over on you. You're never willing to accept them for who they are.
Sure.
I don't know. One of the big changes, too, I've noticed are things like the New York Times, you know, where it used to be you go to the New York Times website and the top of the website was news, and then you went into business and
right.
sports and lifestyle or whatever, and opinions were always kind of at the bottom. They were their own thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now you go to the New York Times and on the left you've got news and on the right you've got opinions.
Yeah.
And that is a huge shift to me in how the media is approaching, you know, bringing the news to us. You know, the media has definitely become, they've taken a side, you know.
Yeah.
They're no longer in the middle. I mean, they have literally picked a side, and that's the side they're going to be on.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't necessarily for Trump in the election, but my gosh, I mean, you couldn't pick up the Post or the Times without – it was just nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this barrage of attacks on Trump was just crazy. I mean, it certainly didn't help, I don't
yeah.
think, the state of how people who were pro-Trump viewed the media. We'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I thought that I find that whole shift too to be really interesting. You know, just how news and how we consume the news, how that's just changed. Mm-hmm. You know, but I don't know, Eric. I don't know what we're gonna do.
And it's so easy to be distracted. This is what Dad used to talk about all the time. He was so against cable television, because he. For a number of reasons, and but one of them he thought was is it gave people too many options other than watching the news. I mean, you know, we're talking about a media landscape of, you know, 1975
through
85. I don't remember him talking about this, but he was saying that, you know, if you have the option, you know, it's kind of like this blue laws argument. If you have the option of watching a, you know, a MASH rerun at 6 versus watching the news, then that makes for a weaker country. And so he was kind of against cable television from a patriotic standpoint, you know. He was.
I just think that's an interesting – I would have never gone down that path.
He was like, this is going to be – this is big business. He thought that basically, big business was, you know, cable television, more entertainment choices, and he would have certainly said the internet now, were foisted upon us by big interests to, distract us from any of us being educated and in tune enough, in step enough, because we'll, you know, human nature will be to take the distraction.
Sure.
And then it can actually boil down to fewer and fewer people making the decisions, and there'll be more money involved and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that was his position. And then you see things like there was a survey that like yesterday, there was a survey about how little people, Crystal is at his, Twitter feed was sharing this. I don't know what the sources of the information were, but anyway, this survey is about, he was talking about how if you're following my Twitter feed, you're so out of step with most of the country. You know, most of the country is not at all deep diving on this stuff. You know, they can't name the branches of government. They can't name anything protected by the First Amendment.
Sure.
Or at least like a third of the country can't. And that was the biggest percentage, not that most of the country, but the biggest percentage of the people survey, even though there was a plurality there, the biggest percentage, they can't even name that stuff. So.
Well, so your dad was right.
Yeah, I think he was. I mean, whether or not the motivation was there, you know, that was the intent. I mean, I do think that the effect.
Well,
is-
I do think I do, and I do believe this. You know, there was a during the Vietnam stuff. So in the 60s, and especially I think in the early 70s, there was a pointed attack made upon universities, mm-hmm. right? And there has for the last 40 years on the right, and it's gotten more and more powerful as 40 years has gone on. There is this notion and this attack that universities are against us, that they're anti-American, that they're, you know, all this stuff. And there is a large swath of people who grow up being taught that. They believe that. They think that way. They see education that way. They, you know, and that has had a huge effect, I think, on our country. I mean, we were talking to somebody just recently whose daughter's getting ready to start college and at a very good university. And all they could talk about was how, well, she's so dreading going there and being attacked by all the liberal faculty and how they're going to oppose everything she believes and, you know, and all this stuff. And I just thought, okay, that's random. I would. I thought the whole point of going to college was to have your what you were thinking of challenged and, you know, you come out with it with stronger opinions and stronger beliefs in what you learned. Yeah. Or you change or whatever. But, you know, it, I always thought the whole point of college was to be challenged, you know, not to just walk through And I don't know. That really struck me. I was surprised by that. It just kind of struck me. But I mean, if you're going into college and that's your attitude about going to college, like, what are you really going to get out of it?
Right.
I don't know. But anyhow, that's something that concerns me too, this sort of anti-education attitude that we've developed. Because I think there was a great piece, I forget where I read it now, maybe it was in The Guardian yesterday, but they were talking about innovation in America. Mm-hmm. And the development of innovation, they were talking about the fact that almost all the innovation that's happened in the country since World War II, for instance, has happened from government investment in research.
Right.
You know, it's not coming out of the private sector research. It's coming – the transistor was developed out of government research money. It wasn't developed in some corporate lab somewhere.
Right.
Because corporations can't take the risk.
Right.
You know, you can't – you can spend money to get something you know you can get. But you can't get money for just pure research, you know. Corporations are never going to do that. And and the amount of money that we're investing in R&D as a country has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking now for 30 years.
Yeah. You know?
So I don't know. I don't know how we got off on that. But I do think that it all feeds back, right?
It's
Hey, hold on. I'll let you go, okay?
Okay.
I'll talk to you later.
See you.
All right. Bye.